Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome to the Tattered Cover. I want to thank you all for coming tonight, and also thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores around the country. Well, we're honored tonight to have Will Schwalbe here with his new book, The End of Your Life Book Club. I have to say, I love this book. If you haven't read it yet, it's an amazing tribute to Will's mother, Mary Ann, and to books and what they inspire in us as readers. Will Schwalbe, formerly Senior Vice President and Editor-in-Chief at Hyperion Books, is now creator and CEO of Cookster.com. He also co-wrote Send, Why People Email So Badly and How to Do It Better. And I think we all wish more people might read that. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Will Schwalbe.
Thank you so much, Marty. That was such a nice introduction. I really appreciate that. And I want to start by saying how incredibly delighted I am to be doing an event at Tattered Cover. Tattered Cover is not just one of my favorite bookstores in the world. It is quite simply one of my favorite places in the world. And I just couldn't be happier to be here. And I'm also deeply grateful to Tattered Cover for their support of me for so many years and their incredible support of this book. I also want to say how incredibly grateful I am to all of you for coming. I have a lot of friends out there, and I really appreciate the support. For my friends, this is just a message for my friends. I know you've been super loyal already. I know you've bought tons of books already, but it would mean so much to me to support Tattered Cover, and I hope you can reach deep down and buy maybe one or two more while you're here. So that would be super. And I'm also really grateful to everyone who just heard about it, took a chance, and decided to come and see what this is all about. And before I go on, I wanted to share some very happy news, which is thanks to the support of great bookstores like Tattered Cover. But the book is very newly out. It's just a couple weeks out, and it hit the New York Times bestseller list already, and I just found out it'll be on for a second week. So I'm really, really happy about that. And this event's going to be different from others I've done in that I'm going to speak for maybe 10 or so minutes, and then it's just going to turn into one big meeting of the book club, and I hope everybody will think of books and stories to share about books that have meant a lot to you, books that you've read or shared with someone you love. So now I'm going to tell you a little bit about the End of Your Life Book Club. This is a book I wrote about the books I read with my mother when she was dying. But it's also a book about how books tell us what we need to do with our lives and in the world. In October 2007, my then 73-year-old mother was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer that had already spread. This is very often fatal within 3 to 6 months. Mom lived for 2 years. My brother, my sister, my father, and I all took turns accompanying Mom to her various doctor's appointments, tests, and to chemo. I usually went with her to chemo. And Mom and I always talked about books, as we had all our lives. And it was actually right away, the very first time I took her to chemo, that we realized that we'd formed a very peculiar little book club, one with only two members, a mother and a son. So this book is about the conversations I had with my mother, what I learned from her, and what we both learned from the books we read, which ranged from Crossing to Safety by Wallace Stegner. That was a book I had always so intended to read that I actually fibbed about reading it, to Big Machine by Victor Laval. We read John Updike. We read Alice Munro. We read Russell Banks, P.G. Wodehouse, Mary Oliver, Geraldine Brooks, J. Jhumpa Lahiri, Khaled Hosseini, Thomas Mann, and that's just to name a few. We read mysteries, we read self-help, and like most book groups, we talked. We talked about things big and small, about courage and faith and death sometimes, and also about writing thank you notes and the importance of shelf liner. My mother was very big on shelf liner. I think it's a generational thing. The book also tells the story of the one last really big thing my mother wanted to do before she died. And that was to raise enough money to help an extraordinary woman she'd met in her travels, a woman named Nancy Hatch Dupree, build a library and cultural center in Kabul, Afghanistan, something Afghanistan didn't have, and also create hundreds of box libraries to go to villages throughout the entire country, to places where not only had they never seen a book in Dari and Pashto, their own languages, but in many cases where they had never seen a book at all. Now, before I tell you about that, I want to tell you a little bit about my mother. My mother had been an educator. She was director of admissions at Harvard when I was growing up. Then she was a guidance counselor at a school called Dalton, and then head of the high school at a girls' school called Nightingale Bamford. And then, when she was in her 50s, she discovered the cause of refugees. And this was thanks to a nun and a mysterious postcard. But if you want the story on that, you have to read the book. She went on to become the founding director of what is now known as the Women's Refugee Commission. And this is the only organization in the world devoted specifically to the cause of women and children refugees, who make up more than 80% of the world's refugee population. Prior to the founding of this, all the refugee organizations were run by men, and they would send men in the camps to talk to men, and women's health issues and children's concerns were almost completely ignored. Now, this work brought my mother to refugee camps all over the world. She went to Gaza, East Timor, Darfur, Bosnia, Liberia many times, Sierra Leone, that's just a couple of the places, and many, many times to Pakistan and Afghanistan, including to the tribal regions, where she was shot at as she was driving into Afghanistan over the Khyber Pass. When I asked her about whether she was scared, she said, "Oh no, they weren't shooting at me, just at the tires." Everywhere she went, she asked refugees what it is they most wanted in the world. And of course, health concerns were always one of the things they mentioned. But there was one other word that always came up, and that word was books. They wanted books for themselves. They wanted books for their children. With books, there was hope. Without books, there was none. Now, among the stories in my book is the story of a miracle. And that's how Mom did manage to get someone to give $1 million to start the construction of the main library in Kabul. And then there was another miracle, which was a couple days after my mother died, the U.S. government started conversations with the library that led to USAID giving the additional $3 million more necessary to build this library. And I'm really delighted to say the main building is done. They're just putting in the shelves and electricity, and this first ever since the Soviet invasion National Library Research and Cultural Center will open in Kabul in December of this year. Also, there are already more than 200 book box libraries in all 34 provinces of Afghanistan. Now, this story is just part of the book. At the center of the book are books. My mother taught me a lot of things, including this, that reading isn't the opposite of doing, it's the opposite of dying. That books are how we take part in the human conversation. That books are a language to discuss the things that are most difficult and yet most important. And that books in whatever form, electronic, even though that wasn't for her, or printed or audio, are how we know what we need to do in life and in the world. Mom would never say to us, "Why don't you put down that book and do something?" For her, reading was doing something, and it was something huge. Now, for the reading part. what I'm going to read to you is part of a chapter from the book called The Uncommon Reader. Oh, before I do this, I should mention, I do have a little riff in the book about how much I usually dislike most author readings. And I point out the main flaw is the author never knows when to be quiet and sit down. So when the reading goes on too long, you can just wave, but I'll try to keep it under control. So this is part of a chapter called The Uncommon Reader. In January 2008, and it was a couple months after Mom's diagnosis and after she started chemo, Mom and Dad had gone back to London, a city they both loved, and a city where Mom had studied in the mid-1950s when she was a drama student right after college. And our family had gone back many times to London for summer and a year's sabbatical. So here's the passage. Keeping with our British theme, we next chose The Uncommon Reader, a novella by Alan Bennett that had just been published 6 months earlier. It was fate that Mom would fall in love with it. How could she not? It was written by one of her favorite writers. It was set in London. It even involved the Queen of England. Also, how could anyone who loves books not love a book that is itself so in love with books? The day after we finished the novella, I saw Mom at her home, and she pointed out to me her favorite passages. Whenever we were together and she came to a passage in a book she liked, she wouldn't read it to me. She would hand the whole book to me with her finger pointing to a line and instructions where I was to start and where I was to stop. There was a certain amount of shuffling involved. As always, she lifted her finger only when she was sure my eyes had found their way to the right portion of the page. It was like the passing of a baton in a relay race. Here are the two passages she pointed to. "Pass the time," said the Queen. "Books are not about passing the time. They're about other lives, other worlds. Far from wanting time to pass, one just wishes one had more of it. If one wanted to pass the time, one could go to New Zealand." The appeal of reading, she thought, lay in its indifference. There was something undeferring about literature. Books did not care who was reading them, or whether one read them or not. All readers were equal, herself included. Days after chatting with Mom about the Alan Bennett, I saw her again at my niece's fourth birthday. By the time my partner David and I arrived, it was full-fledged happy chaos. There was a cubist pinned the tail on the donkey, which was particularly thoughtful because the children couldn't help get it right or wrong and giggled hysterically no matter where the tail landed. There was plenty of alcohol for the adults. There were crafts and the usual complement of New York parents hanging around, sipping wine or Dunkin' Donuts coffee and either encouraging their children to join in or allowing them to stand, thumb in mouth, draped around their mother's legs. In the midst of all of it stood Mom. Her hair was definitely thinner. And even though the studio was hot, she was wearing two layers of sweaters. Lucy, my niece, the birthday girl, was a little feverish, but was trying her darndest to have a great time at the party. And her grandmother was doing the very same thing. Everyone had warned Mom that as someone undergoing chemo, she shouldn't be around people with colds and shouldn't kiss or hug people hello or ride the subway or take the bus. But Mom wasn't going to live like that. So there she was in a scrum of children, about half of whom had runny noses and hacking coughs, completely in her element. After a while, though, I could see she was getting tired. She told me on the phone about the sores on her feet and about how standing and walking weren't great. She broke away from the pack and came to join Dad and David and me. We talked plans as ever. We also talked more about London. She and Dad had walked as much as she could to visit places she loved, she said. She'd even gone back to see the house where she lived in the 50s. She'd seen her oldest godchild and his family, and his father and mother, friends from that first year when she lived there. Her godson's mother was in an advanced stage of Alzheimer's, and Mom said she was amazed at the love and attention her family was giving her, as difficult as it must be. "I feel so lucky," Mom said to me. "I can't imagine what it would be like not to be able to know the people I love, or to read, or to remember books I've already read, or to visit my favorite places and remember everything that happened there, all the wonderful times." We watched Lucy play for a while and also chatted with her 7-year-old brother, Adrian, who was taking a brief break from his duties as the party's entertainment director. "The only thing that makes me really sad," said Mom, once Adrian had returned to the scrum, "is that I won't see the little ones grow up. I really wanted to take them all to Broadway musicals and on special trips and to London." I realized then that for all of us, part of the process of Mom's dying was mourning not just her death, but also the death of our dreams of things to come. You don't really lose the person who has been. You have all those memories. I would always have the summer in Godalming when I was 6 and learned to tie my shoe, and the performance of Giselle in London I'd seen with Mom, my first ballet ever, when Baryshnikov and Gelsey Kirkland danced so brilliantly they got 17 standing ovations, and Mom and I stood side by side with tears rolling down our faces because it was so thrilling. I would even have the times that seemed awful but looked hilarious now, when we arrived in Wales with no hotel reservation and it was impossible to get a room, and we'd driven for hours with me vomiting prodigiously all over my brother and sister. But we were going to have to say goodbye to Mom taking her youngest grandchildren to a Broadway show, or to Harrods to marvel at the food hall and visit the pet store puppies. We were going to have to say goodbye to the little ones, remembering their grandmother, beyond a fleeting image or an imagined memory prompted by a photograph. We would need to say goodbye to Mom at their graduations, and to her buying them clothes, and to them bringing home boyfriends and girlfriends to meet her. We would also have to say goodbye to the joy of watching this next generation soak up the massive quantities of love their grandmother would have given them, and seeing them learn that there was someone in the world who loved them as much as their parents did, a grandmother who was delighted by all their quirks and who thought they were the most amazing creatures on earth. It was an idealized view of the future, but it was the one I carried in my head, and I don't think it was far off from the one my brother and sister and father and mother had. I was learning this, that when you're with someone who's dying, you may need to celebrate the past, live the present, and mourn the future all at the same time. Yet I had a thought right then that made me smile. I would remember the books that Mom loved, and when the children were old enough, I could give those books to them and tell them these were books their grandmother loved. The littlest ones would never see the British Isles through her eyes, but they could see it through the eyes of the writers she admired. They would soon be old enough to read The Railway Children by Edith Nesbit and Swallows and Amazons by Arthur Ransom, and eventually Iris Murdoch and Alan Bennett. They could all be readers, and maybe even uncommon ones. Thank you. So thank you. If anyone has any questions about the book or this or things to share about books they've read and loved. Yes. She did. About 2 months before Mom died. Oh, I have to repeat the question. I'm sorry, because it's being, I think, podcast. The question was, did my mother know that I was writing the book? So about 2 months before Mom died, I'd gone over to her house, to her apartment, and I said in a very kind of weird, inchoate way, you know, Mom, I think I want to write something about the books we've read and the conversations we've had and about you. And Mom, without hesitation, said, oh, you don't want to do that. She said, why would you? You have much better things to write about. Don't write about that. But the next day, an email arrived, and it was a list of all the books that we had read together that Mom had sent me. And then a couple days later, there was, oh, don't forget to include this, and then don't forget to include that. She's very keen that I talk about healthcare reform and refugees. So we never talked about it again, but she definitely knew, and she's kind of my co-writer.
The
whole process, again, the question is, after Mom died, did it change reading for me in any way? The whole process, I think, taught me to look at reading with a little more urgency than I had. One of the reasons I wanted to call the book The End of Your Life Book Club was to emphasize that we're all in the End of Your Life Book Club, that no one knows the last book you'll read, the last conversation you'll have. So I had this concept of really making books count more. I think I have slightly less patience with silly books than I did before, and slightly more voracious appetite. The other thing that definitely happened is, for the longest time, and I think this is very common, I would almost forget that Mom was dead. And a moment would come and I'd wake up and my first thought was, oh, I've got to reach out and call her and tell her how much I'm loving this book or that book. And so when I read books now that I think Mom would have loved, I know she's dead, but I talked to her about them anyways. So the most memorable book I read with my mother probably was Crossing to Safety by Wallace Stegner. That was the book that showed us how much books could and would mean to us over the next 2 years. And it was also in the course of that book, and don't worry, I'm not giving too much away because it's right at the beginning, but there's a woman who's dying of cancer. And her husband is one of the main characters in the book. And I was able to say to Mom, do you think Larry's going to be okay after his wife dies? And Mom said, I think he'll be very sad for a while, but I think he'll be okay. And what I think we both realized in that moment was that we weren't talking about Larry. We were talking about my father. And that book provided us a kind of template of how books can be there for you when subjects may be too painful to go at directly. So that was definitely, I think, at the top of the list. My mother would have put, I think, another book at the top of the list, which was Gilead by Marilynne Robinson. I'm an agnostic. My mother was a very devout Presbyterian. And every now and then, she'd steer the book club a little bit towards faith. And that was definitely when her hand was a little heavier on that rudder. She didn't want to convert me, but she took such comfort from the church that she wanted the same thing for me. So I actually, at the end of the experience, started to realize how many of the books she'd sort of chucked into the book club for that reason.
Did you read any children's books?
The question is, do we read children's books? We talked a great deal about the children's books that I had loved when I was young. That was a great topic. We talked about The Story of Ferdinand, which I think was my favorite, about the bull that just doesn't want to fight, and Harold and the Purple Crayon, which is another book I loved, of the little boy who can draw himself out of any problem. And we talked about my siblings' favorite books. Brother and sister were Sendak people. My brother, Wild Things. My sister, Night Kitchen. We talked about, I had loved The Hobbit as a kid. So I kept bringing The Hobbit into the conversation. My mother was trying to talk about the Book of Common Prayer. I was talking about The Hobbit. I actually related a story in the book about The Hobbit. I read it when we were on vacation during my parents' academic sabbatical in Morocco. And I got really sick. I had a temperature of 105, and it was 1971 or whatever, and they pumped me full of morphine. And that's when I read The Hobbit. So I was just narcoticized out of my mind. And years later, I went back and I thought, oh, this isn't nearly as good as I remember it. So yes, and then also Mom was forever buying children's books for the next generation. The question is, was it an experience just for Mom and me, or were the siblings brought in? My mother had sort of end-of-her-life book clubs with all sorts of people going simultaneously. It's amazing how many people she was reading books with and talking about the books with. Because that's what my mother loved to talk about. I mean, really, what are you reading was one of my mother's big questions for everybody. With my brother and sister, because they both have children, and my mother was an insanely proud grandmother. There was probably a little less book chat and a little more grandchild chat. And my father's tastes run a little more towards nonfiction, so he overlapped more with the nonfiction. But there were people at her office she was reading books and talking about them with. She had all these two-person book clubs going. But we spent an enormous amount of time together because of the chemo. And I think because I had worked in publishing for 21 years, we talked a lot about books.
So did she belong to a book club?
She never belonged to a book club.
Do you think that the idea of book clubs where you have like a dozen people who get together and talk, does that have merit? Or do you really think that only in more personal conversations with one person is there something to be gained from it?
So the question is, do book clubs with, say, 12 people or so have merit, or is there really more to be gained from the one-on-one? I really believe that, like books, there's no one-size-fits-all, and someone loves one book and doesn't like another, and some people love the sort of traditional classic book group. And I actually think my mother would have loved a traditional classic book group. The thing was, because of her refugee work, she traveled so incredibly much that I don't think she could have scheduled one. I was in a very traditional book group for years and had a blast. I dubbed it the world's most serious book club because we read the Bible as literature for more than a year. Then we moved on to Greek tragedy and then Dostoevsky. but we had a lot of laughs. It was much more fun than I'm making it sound. It was. But I do think book clubs aren't for everybody, but they're wonderful for most people. And I do think two-person book clubs are for everybody. There's always someone in your life that you can decide to read a book at the same time. And one of the reactions to the book that made me happiest was someone who got in touch and said that she was a grandmother and that she decided to start a two-person book club with her grandson. And they were reading The Hunger Games together. And when they were reading The Hunger Games, it wasn't grandma and grandson. It was two readers on the edge of their chair trying to figure out what would happen next. So the question is how to choose which books to read. We really, since we read the way normal people do, and because we only sort of gradually realized it was a book club, we started sort of jokingly calling it a book club, and then it became one. We really did, I think, what all readers do and what I suspect many of you do. There were the books on the bedside table that had been there for years that you finally decide, okay, I'm going to read this one. I actually joke about Crossing to Safety. Was a book that I took on so many trips and returned unread to my bedside so many times that I figured if it had frequent flyer miles, it would have earned a first-class ticket to Tokyo. So there were those. Mom was incredibly thrifty, so if anyone gave her a book, she would read it and then pass it on to me. So we had those. Books people talked about, like Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, everybody was talking about it, so we had to read that. And then even up until right weeks before Mom died, if she read a review in the newspaper about a book that sounded interesting or an article, we had to read that book. It sounded interesting, and she'd go across to the bookseller across the street and get a copy or two copies, one for each of us. And so that's why we read Big Machine by Victor Laval. That's why we read Brooklyn by Colm Toybean and books like that.
Did you keep notes about your conversations? How did you remember all?
Question is whether I kept notes about the conversations and how I remembered things. I'm a kind of compulsive note taker, so I keep a lot of random notes. Unfortunately, I don't always date them or say where they're from. So I had a pile of notes, and so that was one resource. I kept a blog to inform the family and friends about Mom's progress. Actually, that was, Mom didn't want a blog. She didn't want to write one. She thought it was immodest, and she said, I'm not a writer. So she said, but Will, if you want to write a blog, you can write a blog. So I wrote Will's Marianne Schwalbe News. But the irony was Mom used to write the entries for me in my voice and then say, maybe you want to post something like this, but you put it in your words, and then there would be the entry. So all of the entries were actually written by Mom up until the very end. And we often mentioned books in those. And then I had all the lists Mom sent me, the notes Mom sent me. So I think I was able pretty accurately to reconstruct everything. And then my brother, sister, father pitched in to help remember things. Friends helped us remember. And then for the medical stuff, I sent it to mom's oncologist and the person who supervised her hospice care to make sure I got everything right-ish. And they said I did, so that was good. I was glad about that.
Did you ever read aloud to each other, like certain passages or parts of the book?
So the question is whether we read aloud to each other. We would do that finger-pointing thing where we would shuffle books and show each other passages. I joke in the book about one of mom's odder propensities, which was she read the end of every book first. She couldn't wait to see what would happen. She was one of those people. And I never did. But so this is a little story from the end of my book. But the only time I really read something entirely out loud to her was a poem by Mary Oliver. And it was the last thing I read to her. And it was a beautiful poem. And I'd actually been supposed to read it at my goddaughter's bat mitzvah. And had to fly back because I knew mom was dying. So I had a friend read the poem at the bat mitzvah in my stead, and I read the poem to mom. And it's a gorgeous poem. It's called Where Does the Temple Begin? Where Does It End? And it's from Why I Wake Early by Mary Oliver. And if you haven't discovered Mary Oliver, and she has a new book out. Does she have a new book out? Yeah. Which I haven't read yet, but I can't wait. So the question is, mom and I were avid readers were there siblings or close relatives that did not read at all? Fortunately, both my siblings are ferocious readers. It would have been very hard to be in my family and not be a reader. So thank goodness that was the case. Most of the people who mom surrounded herself with read all different kinds of stuff. Mom was very active in her church, and many of the people she knew and loved in the church, the Bible was the book that they read. That may have been the only book they read, but mom would talk to them about that. Or, it could be almost anything. Most of the time mom encountered people who read, but she also, especially in her travels to refugee camps, she was always finding, people who didn't. And I think one of the reasons mom loved books is books are a time when you're quiet and you listen to somebody else. You can talk to a book, but it's not going to change the words on the page. And so I would say on a much deeper level than books, mom was interested in stories. And when she was with people who might not read, those people still had stories, and she was fascinated with their stories.
Do you think you ever can convince somebody who doesn't read to become a reader?
The question is, can you convince someone who doesn't read to become a reader? This actually was a question that mom was faced with a lot as an educator. Because when she was head of a high school or a guidance counselor, parents were constantly coming to her and saying, "Oh, we're really upset because our kid doesn't read, and we want our kid to read, and why doesn't our kid read?" And, there were obviously the cases where their child had some kind of reading disability or different learning style, so that's a whole different thing. But in the case of the people whose children didn't have a different learning style, she would just ask them the question, "Do they see you read? Do you come home at night and after dinner pull out a book and sit in front of them and read? Or do you turn on the television? Do you watch movies? Are you on your devices all the time and telling them to read?" Because there's a huge difference. So I think, as far as parents and children, mom was always an advocate of just reading in front of your children. She also wasn't above certain tricks when we were young. One of them was, "Oh, that's much too old for you." As a result, I read, I don't think she may have genuinely meant it was too old for me, but I did read Couples by John Updike. I read Fear of Flying by Erica Jong and the autobiography of Malcolm X all before the age of about 12, I think. but I do think there's something to that. I think especially with young readers, books that they regard as mildly subversive could be enormously appealing. I'm forever giving teens Russell Banks' Rule of the Bone and telling them, "Your parents are so not going to approve of this book," and that works like a charm. Although their parents really genuinely don't approve of the book, so it's a little problematic. Great. All right, well, thank you all so very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.